Hello, I'm Dr. Roger Steiner, director of the Gavin Herbert Eye Institute and professor and chair of ophthalmology at the University of California, Irvine. Welcome to Medscape Ophthalmology Insights, coming from the American Academy of Ophthalmology meeting in New Orleans. Joining me today is Dr. Mark Blumenkranz. Thank you very much, Mark. Dr. Blumenkranz is the H.J. Smead professor and chair of ophthalmology and director of the Byers Eye Institute at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California. We'll be wrapping up the overall highlights in retina from this year's meeting in this section, and also delve into laser technology for both the posterior and anterior segments. I'd like to start by having Mark have you kind of recap the great honor you received of giving the Jackson Memorial Lecture.
Sure. Well, Roger, thanks so much for speaking with me today. The Jackson Lecture this year was on the history and evolution of lasers in ophthalmology, a topic which, interestingly enough, hadn't been covered in 70 years of the Jackson Lecture, including the last 40 or 50, when they've really been an important part of what we do every day in ophthalmology. So I thought it was a good opportunity to look back and look forward a little bit. And so what I tried to do this year was to go back and look at the early history of the laser, because it's kind of an interesting thing from a technology development, from an economic perspective, from a medical perspective. There are lots of interesting lessons that we could learn about how lasers got developed and how they're continuing to change currently.
Well, give us first of all, you personally have done some excellent work and made some real contributions in laser therapy. So let's start with the retina, your area of expertise.
Sure, well, thanks. Well, what I thought would be useful would be to talk about basic mechanisms of laser tissue interactions, particularly in the eye, and then to expand that both on the retina side, and we can cover a little bit about the anterior segment applications as well.
Sure.
So lasers are interesting in that you can choose any number of different wavelengths, ultraviolet, visible, or infrared, and depending on what you're trying to do, what part of the eye or even what part of the retina you're trying to treat, you can choose one of those, and it has to do with the way in which the laser interacts with ocular tissues. If we're starting with retina, photochemical interactions are interesting. They're not the most widely employed, but for instance, photodynamic therapy, which we still have as part of our armamentarium, is really based on photochemical interactions where we're using long pulses of light, relatively low powers. We have to add an additional chromophore. In this case, vertiporphyrin or visudyne is the most commonly used one, and we can achieve some really interesting results. Certainly in retina, for the most part, photodynamic therapy has been superseded by the use of anti-VEGF agents, but for certain types of disease, particularly variants of exudative AMD like choroidal polypoidal vasculopathy, it turns out to be still quite effective, and it has its role perhaps in other less common diseases like central serous. And so photochemical is an interesting option, and as you well know from cornea, it looks as though there may be some really interesting applications, again, using photochemical interactions for collagen cross-linking in the cornea and so forth. I think the real meat of retinal therapy with lasers has really been in the area of photothermal interactions, where we're using somewhat shorter pulse durations and visible wavelengths. Typically, these days we use semiconductor lasers rather than the gas lasers in the general range of green 532. And we're seeing some really interesting opportunities to improve on what we used to use regularly and routinely when you and I were in training in early practice, the so-called ETDRS guidelines, where we used longer berms, we created intense white lesions, whether we were closing aneurysms or doing PRP. And I think we've begun to realize that those early techniques, which worked very well in an era in which there was no alternative, have been to a large extent superseded by newer technologies. And I think the ones that I think are important are, first of all, the use of scanners so that we can apply more than one spot at a time.
And you pioneered that area.
Well, we were. I was privileged to be able to be part of the team that described its use, did some of the early publications and the patent work. And I think to a large extent, we've really concluded the era of single spot laser application for the most part in all the major manufacturers, and most physicians are now using scanning lasers. I think the part that's interesting to me, and something I tried to capture in the Jackson lecture, was the idea that you oftentimes see unexpected findings and really interesting therapeutic insights when you start breaking out of the mold of one technology and into another. For instance, our thinking about using scanners was about going faster, being able to apply 9 spots or 16 spots with a single press of the foot switch rather than one spot. And just doing the math, the time it takes to apply 1,500 spots is dramatically reduced, and you can do it in one sitting, for instance, rather than 3 sittings, and there are fewer blinks, if you will, on the patient's part in terms of responding to a light flash. Now, the interesting part and the unexpected part, if you will, was that we, of course, had to use shorter pulse durations to be able to apply 9 spots or 16 spots or 25 spots in sequence. And in doing that, we came to recognize, and I think this has been validated by multiple peer-reviewed publications by other groups, that shorter pulses turn out to be better than longer pulses. The ETDRS criteria tended to be 100 milliseconds and particular power settings in a white to a yellow-white burn. And what we found was that when we started using these shorter pulses, to our surprise, I suppose, patients said, oh, this is much more comfortable than what we've had before. And we realized that the reduction in choroidal heating that's related to lesser spread from where the laser is absorbed was contributing to that. And the second follow-out of that, aside from the issue of comfort, less pain, was that the burns were more localized to the outer retina and didn't involve the ganglion cell and the layer and the nerve fiber layer. And in doing that, we felt we were avoiding damages, the damage that would contribute to nyctalopia and arcuate scotomas and so forth. And I think that's been borne out as well.
So even though you're not killing as much retina, to put it in crude terms,
right,
you're getting the kind of hypoxic benefit that
we think
drives
so.
PRP?
The irony, Roger, is that more than 40 years or almost 50 years after we started using laser photocoagulation for the treatment, at least of proliferative diabetic retinopathy, and really for DME too, we still don't really know with absolute certainty why the laser works. And there are a lot of theories, and we proposed a few, but so we go back and forth a little bit, and there are some arguments that state that when you do more outer retinal treatment, that in a sense maybe you're not killing enough retina. But my thinking, and I think the way many people's thinking who are knowledgeable about this is that because we have the luxury or the beauty of anti-VEGF pharmaceuticals, we can afford, in essence, to undertreat very slightly if we were going to err on one side or the other and be able to rescue people and then incrementally add more laser that way. And so I think we've got a beautiful confluence between more modern lasers that are available and more modern pharmaceuticals that can work together. I don't think we've settled. There's still quite a bit of controversy as to the relative role. Do we start with pharmaceuticals and then use laser to hold the fort over the longer haul? And some of the data from the Diabetic Retinopathy Clinical Research Network suggests that for instance, drug monotherapy alone is superior to laser plus ranibizumab therapy and potentially some of the other agents as well. And so we're still working through analyzing that data, trying to understand whether that's just true for the short term, in other words, while you're on chronic anti-VEGF therapy, or whether that holds true over many years and decades. And I think that'll be an interesting question that I'm sure is going to need to be restudied so that we really understand what the role of each is, both independently and also in combination with one another.
Yeah. Fascinating. Now, of course, many people know that you were also very involved with the development of the OptoMedica laser in the anterior segment, and recently sold that company to Abbott Medical Optics. Earlier in another segment, we had Dr. Burkhardt Dick, and we talked extensively on his huge experience and where he sees that going, as well as his current results. So that was another congratulations to you for being so involved with all of that. Are you doing any new laser projects, or are you going to emphasize your digital technology?
Well, I think that we've really, interestingly enough, is in a way, lasers have been around for more than 40 years now and fairly common practice, and yet I think we haven't begun to fully explore and exploit, if you will, all the things that can be done. So I would just say the one, and I do want to move on to digital ophthalmology and some other areas, but I would say that one thing that's kind of exciting to me is the use of, when I would say short pulse durations, we're talking single or tens of milliseconds, somewhere between 10 and 20 milliseconds, seems to be moving as the new standard for what I would term semi-conventional laser now, where we produce a visible burn and there is some damage to the retina. I think what a lot of people are excited about, and there's been great work done by other investigators in the United States and Europe, is this idea of what we would call ultra-short pulse durations or very low-energy applications. And the theory behind that is that if you damage only one single layer, let's just say the pigment epithelium, and that can be done pretty reproducibly with microsecond pulses rather than single millisecond pulses, you may be able to achieve other types of benefits, both in diabetic macular edema, and people are starting to talk about whether we can use these lasers to actually get the retina and Bruch's membrane to remodel. So, for instance, in drusen, or even possibly to stimulate the retina to proliferate, slide, and migrate in the purposes of trying to treat geographic atrophy. We don't have nearly as much data as we do for the standard treatments, but these are pretty promising. And one thing that Daniel Palanker in our lab and Daniel Levinsky, who's a former fellow and working in Brazil now, are working on is the idea of very low energy pulses in which there's no visible structural damage, either by ophthalmoscopy or by enhanced imaging techniques, including angiography and OCT and even ultrastructure. And the thinking in this is that you're essentially using lasers to create metabolic changes in cells rather than structural changes. And you might ask, how does that occur? And I think our current thinking is that it relates to the expression of beneficial cytokines, in particular heat shock protein, which from its name is something that is produced within the cell, has very strong neuroprotective and other beneficial features. And we've now been able to show both in animal models and also in some initial human studies that it's possible to achieve profound improvements in diabetic macular edema without the use of any visible lesions at all, including damage that would be considered irreversible and structural to the retina. So I think that's promising, and I think what it points to is this idea that we may be moving towards an era in which we're using lasers with increased precision and increased dosimetry, both, in other words, structural precision, just treating only what we want to treat and nothing else, in time and space, and creating drug-like effects. So I think we may be seeing drugs and lasers that are starting to act more and more like one another, as opposed to being defined into very narrow conventional buckets that we've always thought of.
Wow, that'll take us to a new era if that all works out.
Well, it's exciting. I want to stress it's preliminary. It has not been subjected to the same types of rigorous prospective randomized clinical trials. But I think all this research always begins with a demonstration of proof of concept. Starts with animal models. It moves to initial preliminary studies, and then finally, when there's enough knowledge to be able to really intelligently design a trial that's, adequately powered to prove or disprove a point, I think that's when we all develop that level of comfort that this is something that really does work.
So, changing gears now, digital technology and ophthalmology in particular. Tell us about some of the exciting work you're doing there.
Well, I really love the idea that we have to use all the digital tools that we're kind of comfortable with in our personal lives and in the rest of our business lives, and to bring those into ophthalmology. It just seems like it's a natural evolution that is destined to occur, and it'll be fun to try to help direct that a little. So I would say the underlying principle in my mind is that we're now able to collect so much data. The real problem is, how do you process that data? How do you use it both to develop disease insights, develop treatment regimens, and how to personalize therapy? And I think in those three realms, digital tools make it easier. We have, for instance, just from the GWAS studies, the genome-wide association studies, we've been able to identify genes that we never dreamt of as having any relationship whatsoever to disease. So the complement genes, for instance, or the ARMS2 locus, the two big drivers of age-related macular degeneration, trying to figure out, it's easy enough now to either do SNP analysis. You know, some of the commercial companies are doing it. There's a lot of controversy around, yeah, what do we do with that data? I suppose you could argue that if you're a person that wants to know what your lifetime risk is because you want to modify certain risk factors, whether it's diet, exercise, or perhaps even lifestyle or choice of profession, that's one thing. If you are going to use that to begin a specific therapy, that requires probably a little higher level of expertise. And so I think that's where having the ability to do that. I think, for instance, if you look at in the United States today, we spend over $2.5 billion on anti-VEGF compounds, and that's going up rather quickly. I like to liken it to the initial introduction of insulin, where when it was discovered, it was so life-changing for patients and so revolutionary in medicine that people would use it once a day. They'd come in and see the doctor every 3 months, and maybe they'd switch the dose and say, well, maybe we're going to give you a little more, a little less. And I think that to some extent, this is a little hyperbole, but it's not too far off the mark. That's how we kind of use anti-VEGF agents now. And I think it's clear that one size doesn't fit all, whether it's the drug or the individual or even perhaps the time and life of that individual. And so we have to have better ways to do that. And I think the out-of-office monitoring of various functions, whether it be vision or perhaps someday maybe OCTs or other psychophysical measures, hard to say. But I think getting that data is going to be critically important in individualizing therapy and developing insights. For instance, how do we know what the true half-life from a functional perspective is of these agents without knowing what they're doing? So I think that's an area. And I think the idea of facilitating communication between doctors and physicians, getting information to patients, finding people to participate in clinical trials, exchanging information between physicians, different care providers, whether it's a diabetologist and a retinal specialist, those are critically important functions that we just don't do well.
Yeah.
Fax machines and phone calls are not the answer to what I would call complex coordinated care, and that's the thing that I would say we're trying to do at Stanford across the board, whether it's ophthalmology or dealing with chronic diseases, is to really figure out how to coordinate care between the different providers. So, because we all know it's really medicine is kind of a team sport, as opposed to the era of the master clinician who could do it all. And I think that's again where digital tools, and even things like swept source, you know, OCTs, I've been looking at some of the new images, which allow us to not only produce the cross-sectional anatomy, but to reconstruct and render retinal images that are arguably more informative than even a traditional photograph, to me is stunning. Who would have thought when we saw the first, and I know you were in Boston working with Carmen when this technology was first developed, the idea that we would be able to look to create these slices both in various different planes is just stunning, and I've been quite encouraged by seeing that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, and it's easy to kind of grasp that here we have moved, because you mentioned diabetes and insulin, we've moved to an era where patients test their blood sugar multiple times a day, and the insulin dose is modulated real time.
By the hour.
By the hour, exactly. And we start having meaningful home and reliable home vision testing of various kinds on apps, on phones, whatever, and then know when to re-intervene with an anti-VEGF drug to prevent disease progression, whatever it is. You know, that connection is so clear-cut that that's where we need to be going.
Well, part of it, aside even from the patient's perspective, if we look at workflow, you as a chair know that just trying to figure out efficient ways to run an office, to get the people in that need to be seen, to not burden patients that really don't need to be seen so frequently with office visits. I mean, I think it speaks even to the medical economics of looking at this conversion from medically optimal medicine to socially optimal medicine, where we find some reasonable balance between cost and effectiveness. And I think these are the tools that are going to try to help us.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I'd like to thank you very much for taking time from your very busy schedule, compounded with the honor of the Jackson Lecture and all the work that went into that, both preparing and presenting it. And so thank you for taking the time to come here and share your insights. This is Dr. Roger Steinert with Dr. Mark Blumenkranz for Medscape Ophthalmology. Thanks for joining us.